Don't blame Jasper. Aw.
Wow, I think this is the first
They're
time.
All blaming Jasper. It is not Jasper's fault that we're late. Hello, everyone. I'm Kimberly Adams. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we make today make sense. It's Friday, April the 26th.
And I am Megan McCarty Carino in for Kai Rizdahl. I thought I could do without my second set of headphones, but no, I need them. It is Friday. Thanks for joining us on this podcast and the YouTube live stream. And it's time for our weekly happy hour episode. I'm ready for it.
Yes,
it's economics
for sure.
On tap.
Yes, we're going to get to some news. We're going to take a break and then we're going to play a game. But before we get to it, Megan, what are you drinking? Although I already know. And anybody who looked at the newsletter knows.
Right. So I am drinking a Cynar Spritz. I believe that's how the Italians say it. It is an artichoke Amaro. And I was inspired by the kind of glut of beautiful artichoke plants I've been seeing in my neighborhood with artichokes all growing out of them and the beautiful thistle flowers. And so I decided to try some Cynar, which is an artichoke Amaro. What are you drinking?
Have you had it before?
I have had it before. I have never bought a full bottle of it before.
Yeah, you're gonna have it for a while.
I'm a bitter and kind of odd gal, so I'm into it.
I saw that you were making that, and so I have Cynar. Your face, oh my gosh, Megan.
Ooh,
was it a little too bitter?
Artichoke.
I saw that you were making it, and so I was like, you know what? I've got some Cynar. I'll try it, too. I have Prosecco. So we're doing these Cynar spritzes. I'm in the office, so I don't have a proper wine glass. So I decided to make one, too.
We have matching Cynar spritzes.
Yay!
How cute are we?
Very cute. It was a little too bitter for me, and so I took the option of adding a little fruit-flavored sparkling water. We add a little dash of citrus. What is your news?
I think I need another drink before we start this, but I thought that, you know, that we should just take a beat and, like, acknowledge what's been going on college campuses for the last week and
a half.
Things have been tense. There have been, you know, mass demonstrations, police arresting people on college campuses, which is, I mean, that's pretty remarkable. It's, you know, something that hasn't really happened at this level in decades, more than half a century, pretty much, since, you know, the student protests of 1968. And USC canceled its main commencement ceremony, you know, kind of without wading into, you know, characterizing the nature of these protests and kind of,
I mean,
you know, what they're about.
Palestinian protests.
Sure.
I guess in terms
of whether with the degree to which they are, you know, causing violence and threats on universities and that kind of stuff, whether universities have taken the right actions or not, whether they're justifiable. I think that a lot of people probably at those universities and in the country, no matter where you kind of stand on this stuff, probably feels that a university has done something to alienate you in the last, definitely in the last, you know, week and a half, and probably in the last, you know, half of a year. And just kind of looking at it within this broader trajectory of a growing loss of faith in the institutions of universities. I was just, you know, I was just checking out today, both the New York Times and the Washington Post had profiles of students on college campuses, you know, just kind of students who are involved in protests to various degrees, students who are completely uninvolved, who are just trying to finish their year. And the kind of theme that I saw, these are many of the students who are graduating this year were graduating from high school in 2020. So had completely disrupted senior year of high school, went to college, you know, and college campuses are, yeah, again, no matter where you stand, I think for a lot of folks on college campuses feel unsafe, feel, you know, that the institution has failed them in some way. So I was just really struck by what these college students were saying. One of them, I think, said kind of something that encapsulated it, which was just that, you know, I'm leaving college with this terrible taste in my mouth, and kind of connecting that to the economics of universities, which is kind of what we're about here, is just looking at, you know, I mean, college enrollment has been dropping. It saw a drop after COVID because obviously, you know, I think folks were not wanting to take out huge amounts of student loans to go do Zoom university and be stuck in their dorm rooms and that kind of thing. But there is kind of a looming cliff for college enrollment, which is that 2025, I guess, sort of demographically is seen as the peak of high school graduating classes in terms of the number of students. So there is a kind of natural, just because of the sizes of generations and kind of declining, you know, fertility rates and that kind of stuff in the country, and that college enrollment has been going down and it will continue to go down kind of precipitously after 2025. Again, you know, we're not kind of talking about it at these elite institutions like Columbia, Yale, Stanford, USC, you know, that have kind of tiny admissions rates. But in general, public opinion has been pretty negative on universities. The Wall Street Journal had a poll last year that showed a majority of Americans don't think a college degree is worth the cost. Gallup polling showing kind of a decreasing share of Americans, and particularly young Americans, kind of having a favorable view of four-year college degree. And often the kind of reason that is cited, the most cited reason in the Wall Street Journal poll, was that it just wasn't worth the money, that the economic return was not worth it. And I think, you know, I don't know, I just, my assumption is that the kind of bad publicity that many universities have been getting over the last, you know, year or so, with so much conflagration and congressional hearings, and you know, I do not envy university administrators, but there have been some pretty remarkable things, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting that point you made a few minutes ago, where you were saying that, you know, everybody now has a reason to be mad at universities. You had conservatives mad at universities for, you know, DEI initiatives and for, you know, being too woke. And now you have more liberal folks being upset at, you know, this perceived crackdown on freedom of speech. And it also really brings in, and I was thinking we should do a story on this, about the power of endowments. And the funding model for especially a lot of these private universities, and even the public ones to some extent, that rely so much on donor largesse to, you know, handle certain amounts of the way that these universities are run, which makes them beholden in some ways to the whims of said donors. And that is worth exploring. And I mean, every time I, you know, hear people, particularly older people, complaining about, oh, you know, younger generations don't know how to spend their money and, you know, blah, 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 you shouldn't have taken on so much debt. Every so often I'll go back and look at, like, how much college actually cost for older generations, particularly relative to average salaries and things like that. I think Janet Wynn did a really good breakdown of this on Marketplace's website at one point, and it's just astronomical how much more expensive it's gotten.
Right.
And
the
level of just crushing debt that so many people are dealing with. And then, so you have to imagine the stakes for some of these students, right? You're in a very expensive school. I mean, at some of these schools, probably, you know, there's certain financial demographics at play. But I mean, you're spending all this money to be in school and you are choosing to sit it out, right? You're choosing not to go to class. You're choosing not to to potentially get kicked out of school, potentially be arrested, because you care deeply about a cause. And, you know, that's a decision. That's tough. And I hope that, you know, right now it seems the vast majority of these protests are peaceful. Mm-hmm. Let's hope people can keep the anti-Semitic language out of it and the anti-Muslim language out of it and actually keep focused on, you know, the policy change goals that these students, I believe, are advocating for. And hopefully it'll remain as calm as possible, which they, for the most part, have been, it seems. Yeah. But anyhow. Oh, boy. Right. Nick asked a really interesting question. Do we see protests at trade schools? No. As Jason says, they're too busy working. That's a very interesting point. And the trade school thing is such a big part of the discussion, I think a growing part of the discussion.
Yeah.
Because, and I've done some reporting on this, and I know you have as well, and to a lot of young people, just is a better option, right? Because you're going to make your money back, for sure, and your skills are in demand, and it's faster.
But,
you know, I guess we just, when I was doing the reporting on this, the people running these sort of training organizations said they just have to fight against the elitism, basically the classism around it, because they said everybody's wants their kid to go to college to be a doctor, but a lot of people don't want their kid to go to trade school to be a plumber. And until we, you know, shake that stigma, it's not going to get any better because we need plumbers as much as we need doctors. Yes, we do need plumbers as much as we need doctors.
Yeah.
Anyway, we Karen said, please do an article on trade schools. We have. You can find them on marketplace.org. We've done several. All right. I should move on to my news, which is this exclusive in the Wall Street Journal. It's pretty blockbuster, where they got access to this 10-page document that some Trump allies have put together that calls for, if Trump were to win, for him to get more control over the central bank, over the Federal Reserve. So it said, former Trump administration officials and other supporters of the presumptive GOP nominee have in recent months discussed a range of proposals, from incremental policy changes to a long-shot assertion that the president himself should play a role in setting interest rates. A small group of the former president's allies, whose work is so secretive that even some prominent former Trump economic aides weren't aware of it, has produced this document, right? And so this group of the group of Trump allies argues that he should be consulted on interest rate decisions, and the draft document recommends subjecting Fed regulations to White House review and more forcefully using the Treasury Department as a check on the central bank. The group also contends that Trump, if he returns to the White House, would have the authority to oust Jerome Powell as a Fed chair before his four-year term ends in 2026. Right. And it could the journal says it couldn't be determined whether or not Trump was aware of this effort or signed off on this document. But this would be very bad for the economy.
There's no
kind of waffling on that. And global markets would not like that very much. And when we think about potential consequences to the economy and to the global economy of a second Trump term, things like this are what other world leaders are looking at as they are trying to plan, and what, you know, risk agencies are looking at. And this Catherine Rampell did a really of the Washington Post did a really detailed thread sort of breaking down what some of the consequences of these sorts of changes would do, as did the Wall Street Journal. And Catherine was on the Weekly Wrap on the PM show today, and I was chatting with her beforehand saying how I'm trying to decide sort of as a reporter at what point do we really start getting into the nitty-gritty of the policy proposals of the presidential candidates, because we're a bit early in the cycle for the fully formed strategies that they're going to run on. And also, presidential candidates tend to promise things on the campaign trail they have no power to do. Right. But, like, when in the news cycle do we really need to start digging into these policies in order to make sure that everybody has the information they need to go to the polls? And so I'm sort of trying to figure that out. So, yeah, that's what I got for news.
All right.
Did you see that story?
That's a heavy-duty one. Yeah, I mean, and it called to mind for me, you know, when Trump was president and kind of the shock when he criticized Jerome Powell, saying, you know, that he had kept, was, you know, was, you know, setting rate policy according to political, you know, kinds of considerations and just that at that time, that was seen as this, you know, kind of unprecedented thing that he would sort of publicly speak out against.
Right.
Yeah. So
and
this
then
is the next
that
level.
That time that he basically hinted at the jobs numbers before they came out. Remember that? Memory lane. All right. That is it for the news. We are going to take a break. And when we come back, we are going to play a round of half full, half empty. We will be right back.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
I feel like I traumatized y'all in the chat with that story. Sorry. People are going back for an extra drink. All right, we are back. It is now time to play Half Full, Half Empty, hosted by the amazing Drew Jostad, who I don't even think gets a drink for the game. I'm sorry, Drew.
He's fully empty.
Nobody ever asked me about that.
I'm sorry, man.
No, I had a peppermint fennel tea today.
Nice. That sounds delicious.
No Chinar spritz, but... Anyway.
All right, what's half full, half empty? What are we going to
do? First topic comes from Fox Business. This is some new buzzwords. We remember quiet quitting. The next one, we have resenteeism, which would be low productivity due to resentment toward your job, and bare minimum Mondays. Are you half full or half empty?
I don't want to, like, get myself in trouble.
Apple, I will just say, I'm always half empty on these made-up, stupid workplace trends as the workplace reporter. I actually got pitched on this,
resenteeism?
Resenteeism?
Like absenteeism?
I literally thought it was, a typo when I got the email. And then I was like, oh no, resenteeism. Because I thought it was presenteeism, which is not kind of a, you know, made up trend, but kind of an actual, you know, problem that in HR of people who come to work when they shouldn't because they're sick or whatever. But yeah, no, I'm half empty on quiet quitting, quiet firing, resenteeism. This is hard to say. I don't know where to put the emphasis. It's half empty.
It's bad branding.
Put the emphasis on the syllables. I am half full because I actually like the idea of naming these things. Like, I don't think it needs to be trendy. I don't think it needs to be memed. But I do think that naming something allows you to address it, right? And I think that when these terms come up, and the quiet quitting, the resentism, whatever, it's reflective of especially a generation that is like, we're not going to keep working for people who treat us poorly and then have you expect max output from us. If you're not paying me appropriately, or if I have no stake in the success of the work that I'm doing and my managers are not great, and then you expect me to show up and bring 100%, hard pass. You know, hopefully some manager out there will hear that this is a thing and be like, oh, what can I do to make sure that my employees are not so resentful that they choose to only bring the bare minimum to work? Let me be better at life, you know? So I'm half full on it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'll give that to you.
Next up, are you half full or half empty on the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which is tomorrow?
Oh, who's the host? I haven't
Colin
kept up
Jost.
With this. Okay.
So I was talking to Sean McHenry, who's one of the producers and the director on the PM show today, about how I've never been to the Correspondents' Dinner. I've never been invited to the Correspondents' Dinner. And I got a text from a friend of mine in New York, and she was like, hey, I'm in town for the Correspondents' Dinner. Are you going? And I was like, no, Miss Editor-in-Chief of a news website, I have never been invited to the Correspondents' Dinner, because you have to be a member of the White House Correspondents Association. Marketplace doesn't have a White House correspondent. And also, you... the individual news organizations buy tables. It's a big thing. And so, no, I'm not going to the Correspondents' Dinner. I have been invited to some of the parties and the after parties and things like that, but I'm not going. I don't feel like going out this weekend. I'm going to be at home. But in terms of the Correspondents' Dinner, I'm going to say half full for purely personal reasons, in that a lot of my friends really like it, and I love seeing my friends all dressed up and their nice dresses, and they all have a great time, and the associated parties here in D.C. can be fun, and it's a little Hunger Games level of excess in terms of, like, the capital city going wild on its own ego, but, you know, it's what we got.
I feel very torn here. I'm half full on the jokes that come out. They're usually like pretty good, and I like to watch, you know, the highlights reels and that kind of thing. I don't know though on the whole the glittery schmoozy thing with the press and the president. Like, I think it's always like nice when you can get together with your colleagues, and I'm sure it is a really intense and really
it's a hard job.
It's such
job.
A pressure cooker, and I'm sure that it's nice to kind of let off steam and laugh and have some, you know, time to do that. But on principle, I don't know if I like it. The schmoozer.
You know what? We can both report back once we've actually gone. How about that?
All right.
What's the next one?
Okay, a new bill working its way through the California State Senate would put regulations on Clear, which is the private airport security fast track company. Are you half full or half empty on security line cutters?
Somebody commented when I posted that story in Slack that it's funny to see, like, the people paying $89 to cut the line mad at the people who paid like $100-something to cut the line. And so, as a long-term member of TSA PreCheck, I there are some serious security considerations around Clear that have been raised by some other reporting. I also think that it's a little weird to be having a private company that plugged in with, you know, the security component of flying. And yes, of course, it's security theater. This is not the way that we catch most terrorists and most threats to the flying public. But, you know, I'm half full at taking another look at that relationship.
So with Clear, is that one, what kind of biometrics are used in that?
I think it's your eyes or your
face.
I don't know if it's your eyes or your face.
I'm half empty on that. Private company With the, it's, I actually tried
They've
to
got it already.
I tried to sign up for one of them. I think it was that one. I think it was Clear. Mm. While I was waiting in line at the airport, I got accosted by like a salesperson, and he was like, "Yeah, just see if you can, you know, let's just like see whatever if your credit card covers it or something." And they could not verify my identity. So I couldn't do it. So I'm like Hana, like I got my, you know, like the show with the girl who's like off the grid, you know, I don't know. Yeah, I have no identity. Yeah. And
must be nice.
That's cool. I don't know why. They couldn't verify
All
my
right,
identity.
What else we got, Drew?
Yesterday was Take Your Child to Work Day. Marketplace Morning Report had a story about the 5-year-old son of a high school basketball coach who helps his dad coach his team. You half full or half empty on Take Your Kid to Work Day?
All the way full. Love it. And we'll remind our dear listeners of the time that on a Take Your Child to Work Day that shall forever live in infamy, some kid turned off NPR for like more than a minute. Because they were giving these kids a tour of the studios, and they pushed like just the right combo of buttons in the
Wait,
studio.
Is there, yeah, I mean, I'm, is there one
NPR
button that can
air.
Turn off NPR? Oh my
it,
God.
I don't know, but it was hilarious. So
wow.
I am all the way full. And I remember my dad taking me to work with him sometimes, and I always thought it was cool to walk the factory floor and stuff like that. So all the way
I'm
full. What about you?
I'll do all the way full, too. I forgot that's not really an option. But, yeah, I'll do all the way full on
the
that.
Options are what we get, what we make them.
That story, by the way, for those who have not listened to that story, is one of the cutest things you will ever hear on Marketplace, which, you know, doesn't always have the cutest things, but it is the cutest thing. I used to go with my dad to work. He worked, like, swing shift at the hospital as a nurse when mm-hmm. I was a kid. And the best part of that was the cafeteria where they had sugar cereal in those little tiny, tiny little boxes.
Boxes,
and I would just,
yeah.
I would just stock up on those.
I didn't. The reason I always went with my dad to work was because my mother worked at the school that I attended. So I was always at work with my mother.
Yeah. My mom was kind of like a freelancer, so she didn't have a workplace. So she had nowhere to take me.
The home.
Yep.
All right, what's next? Is this the last
next
one?
Next is the poll.
Yes. All right, everybody get ready. I know we've been like chatting everybody for so long. So, yes, everybody in the chat, get ready for the poll. Let's do it.
All right, I'm going to give the prompt, and then I'll give you the backstory. Half full or half empty on AI-generated cocktail recipes. Last month, a Houston cocktail bar had a humans versus machines special drink menu where patrons could compare four human-designed cocktails with four ChatGPT ones and vote for the winners. So are you half full or half empty on robot
beverages?
I feel like
everyone's going to know my take on this since I have openly made cocktails based on what I got from ChatGPT. What about you?
Well, I think this is probably one of the maybe safer uses of AI, although I will say I have gotten some odd combinations. Maybe not as odd as putting an artichoke in your cocktail, but on the order of it. I'm half full on this, you know?
I feel like even though I can get really great ideas from ChatGPT on cocktails, and especially if it's like, I have these ingredients, what can I make?
Yeah.
It's helpful for that.
Right.
I do think that a good bartender and mixologist is just magical. And the way that they can use the human creativity to layer flavors and presentation and like the smoke and the performance art of it. I think that there's always going to be like a beautiful human touch to a well-crafted drink. So I am half full on this existing, but I don't think it's going to meaningfully make us not want to go to bars. All right, Drew, let's close the poll. What we got? The poll says half full, 52%, half empty, 47%, with 167 votes. So pretty good split. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. That is it for us today. Kai and I will be back on Monday. But in the meantime, if you want more Make Me Smart in your life, which of course I am sure you do, sign up for our newsletter. This week, we're getting into the power of product reviews. By the way, you can leave us a review on your podcast platform of choice or on YouTube. Hopefully a nice one.
Only if it's nice.
Yeah. Well, you know, we like honesty. But product reviews and whether they can actually tank a company or a podcast. You'll also get links to what we are reading in the newsletter and, of course, drinking. So subscribe to the latest issue at marketplace.org/smarter. Make Me Smart is produced by Courtney Bergseeker. Today's episode was engineered by Charlton Thorpe, and our intern is Talia Menchaca. We've got it together.
The team behind our Friday game is Emily McCune and Antoinette Brock. Marissa Cabrera is our senior producer. Bridget Bodner is the director of podcasts, and Francesca Levy is the executive director of Digital On Demand.
Yes. They're requesting a chair dance, Megan, in the chat. Gotta
give a little chair dance.
Yeah. There you go. Everybody be happy.
Chair.
Ah, well, there you go. You got good posture.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Jerez, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.